Eveen and Company with Eveen Ihuliwan on RTE Radio 1.
Good morning. Recently, I had the pleasure of meeting Miss Ireland 1961. Olive Browning, formerly Olive White, was born in Dublin, reared in Crumlin, and after a whirlwind romance, married an Englishman called Kitts Browning. They now live in Cornwall and have 4 children and 6 grandchildren. Olive comes from a very ordinary family in Dublin, but hers is an extraordinary life. As a teenager, she had a career in modelling and film, and she was one of the well-known faces in the early years of Irish television. Her husband's parents were Lord and Lady Browning. Olive's mother-in-law was better known to the wider world as the writer of such novels such as Rebecca, My Cousin Rachel, and Don't Look Now. She was Daphne du Maurier. I travelled to Cornwall recently to meet Olive and to talk about her life and times. It was my first visit to that part of England, and I asked her, could she recall for me her first time visiting Cornwall as a young girl of 19?
I came during the night. I came first to meet my prospective in-laws, and I had no idea anything about Cornwall was alien to me. But when we got to sort of Menabilly, I do remember Kit saying, darling, will you get out and open the gates? I opened gates, I got back in the car, we drove on. Darling, will you get out and open the gates? And I thought, right, out I got, open gates, got back. This happened 3 times, and I thought, oh heavens, where are we? Only to find myself outside this amazing house called Menabilly, with Kitts's parents both outside waiting to welcome us in, or me in. It was fairly dark, so I didn't really take in the house mm-hmm. and the situation. And it was the next morning when I went out for a walk through the parklands, through various gates. It was just simply amazing. Just the most beautiful house ever.
And usually, you know, meeting your in-laws for the first time, that can be quite daunting. So what was it like meeting Daphne du Maurier and her husband, Lord Browning, for the first time?
You know, honestly, they couldn't have been nicer. You must remember, Kitts was their only son, and Daphne's the love of her life, really. She adored him. The sisters would tell you that as well. So, and everybody kept saying, this could be very tricky, but she couldn't have been nicer. And I was made incredibly welcome from the very beginning.
And did you realise how well known she was at the time?
I had only ever read one book of hers, which was Jamaica Inn. And I didn't take it. I was very young. I didn't, you know, I was so full of my own importance at the time. No, I really didn't have any idea.
And of course then Daphne du Maurier and Lord Browning became your parents-in-law when you married their son Kitts. And we'll have a chat about that later, Olive. But I want to talk first about this piece of music that brings us back to your roots and to your family home in Crumlin in Dublin. Why have you chosen the song Little Things Mean a Lot?
I tell you why. It was a favourite of my mum's. And if you listen to the lyrics, it was what she was actually trying to teach us as children. You know, be nice to people. Little things do mean a lot. Help people out if you can. And it's always stuck with me and my sisters. And it's a very special memory of my mum.
Blow me a kiss from across the room. Say I look nice when I'm not. Touch my hair as you pass my chair. Little things mean a lot.
Olive, that's a gorgeous old-fashioned song. When do you remember your mom singing that to you?
I just always remember her humming it. You know, if we came home from school, it was all... And it was just something that always, you know, remained with me mm-hmm. about her.
And you were her youngest child. I was fascinated to learn that you were born with a caul, because when I first heard that, I really didn't know what it meant. So could you explain that to me?
Well, it's when the baby's just about to be born, the sack with the water breaks, and obviously then the baby comes out. In very rare cases, it comes back over the baby. And unless you have a very bright midwife and or doctor, the baby will drown in the water and suffocate with the bag, the membrane, going back over it. So you've got to get the baby out very quickly, and they have to see what's going on, and then they remove this membrane, which I still have. It's now like very, very fine tissue paper, but it's in the shape of a little head and little shoulders. and I've put it away safely. And I'm quite sure if my children, when I'm gone, find this, they'll think, oh, bit of old paper, throw it away. But I've written on it, this is very, very, very important, because you're meant to be incredibly lucky, because you should have gone.
Oh, so that's where the fortune comes in, because there is an old wives' tale that if you're very lucky if you're born with the veil of the call.
Yes, there's also, I mean, I've actually looked it up too, and it gets very complicated, because it can be terrifically religious. In some religions, it's a sort of sign of all sorts of things, and you're held as a holy person. In my case, I have to tell you, it wasn't that. My mother just told me, remember, you were born a very, very lucky.
And did you have that sense of that growing up, that you were very lucky, or that you had a sense of destiny?
Well, do you know, I always seemed to be in the right place at the right time. I was very lucky, because when I left school very young, I worked in a grocery shop. And one of my customers, a lovely, lovely lady called Mrs. Nelson, she couldn't carry her shopping around. So whatever she needed, I'd take around to her house when I'd finished work. And her daughter worked for a very prominent dentist in Dublin called Jerry Owen. And she said, you shouldn't be in a shop. You should be doing, what would you like to do? So, of course, little girl, model.
And what age were you at this time?
I was 15, I think. 15 and a bit.
Why did you leave school?
I wasn't very clever, I have to say. I mean, I got away with as little as I could. I very rarely in the summer went back after lunch. I could be found in Stephen's Green feeding the ducks.
You bold?
I was very bold. I was incredibly bold. I gave the poor nuns a terrible run around, and indeed my mother. So she was more than happy that I left school when I did.
And it was the norm at the time as well.
Yes, yes. I mean, my other sisters stayed on. They were very clever, but there's always one in a family, and it was me. But Mrs. Nelson's daughter took me to this dentist, who redid all my teeth for me, free. And all he ever wanted was my first photograph of my modelling career.
That's very generous of him.
And my first job I got was a huge poster for Player Cigarettes. For a 16-year-old girl, probably these days it wouldn't go down too well, but he was thrilled because you could see the teeth. Mm-hmm. Not quite what he had in mind for my first job, but hey, it was a job.
So you're 16 and you're on billboards all over the city. How did that feel?
Good, very good. In my family, you couldn't get carried away with anything, with three older sisters and my mum, who was like a hawk, watching where I went, who I saw, what time I had to be in by. So we were very grounded, but it was a thrill.
And so you were the youngest, Olive. Do you think that you were a bit spoiled?
Absolutely not, no. Nobody in our family was spoiled. Everybody did their bit.
And what about your dad? Because he was in a house full of women.
He was. I was the sort of near as he got to having a boy, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went to the football matches with them and I did all sorts of things that a boy would do, got into trouble, cut myself, fell over, all those sort of things. So, yeah, Daddy and I had a great time.
You were very close to your father then. And he was a plumber around Dublin. Was that a good trade to have?
I think it was sort of just a good trade, and there was always work. Mm-hmm. Yes, he was great.
And can you tell me why your mom would have saved for you to go to elocution lessons?
I don't think she just saved for me. The other girls were working. Nancy was working. Dorry was working. And it was Laurie and I then left. And so I think there was a little bit of extra money coming in because the other two girls were working. And she just really wanted the best that, she could for us. Mm-hmm. They weren't great elocution lessons, just sort of something for us to do, probably to keep us out of trouble, if the truth be known. But I think it took the edge off the Dublin voice. I'm going to be hated for saying that, but it just took the edge away from the Dublin voice.
And would it have been the norm? Like, would there have been other girls your age doing those lessons as well?
Not from where we lived, they weren't, no. But she did try her best for us. She tried very, very hard to do the best she could by us.
And when you said that your mother was trying to keep your feet on the ground, were there curfews that she, imposed on you then that you had to rebel against?
Yes, yes, and yes again. Mum didn't realise, really, because the other girls, my sisters, all sort of conformed to doing what was expected, what they were told to do. And she didn't really realise that, in the modelling thing, things didn't kick off until 9:30, 10 o'clock in the evening. And I had to be in by 10. So I had to sort of weigh up the risks, you know. Was it worth actually getting a telling off, or indeed being locked out, or indeed not being allowed to do something else?
Would she have locked you out?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And then I used to have to go around and throw stones up to my sister's thing, and she said, "You get me into trouble." She used to sneak down and let me in.
You were a real rebel then.
There's no question I was. I gave my mum a... I wanted just to try everything. It was just all kicking off, you know, in Dublin at that time. It was really a really exciting time to be sort of on the edge of everything, you know.
And who had you looked up to want to be a model, or was this what every girl aspired to be at the time?
Well, we had the Adrian Rings, and you probably won't know that, you're far too young. We had some very glamorous models then. So it was just getting to the sort of, the look was becoming not quite so elegant and that bit more streetwise. And that's when I sort of came into it, really.
And tell me, how did you come to enter the Miss Dublin competition?
Two of my older sisters, Laurie and Dorry, were going to a dance. And I bellyached that I want to go too. So they had to take me. They didn't want me to go at all. You know, they wanted fun because it meant they had to all be back early because I was with them.
What age were you?
I was sort of 16 and a bit. But Mum said, yes, they could go, providing they took me. And at the dance, there was a heat for Miss Dublin. So all the girls were pulled in, you know, like they do. They go around saying, you, 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 you. But either of my sisters or one of my sister's friends called Irene Bell, any one of those girls could have been chosen that evening. It happened to be me. That's where the luck came into it again.
What was it like in Dublin at the time? Because, you know, you're coming out of the greyness of the 1950s and television had just started. So, you know, what was it like? Was it an exciting place to be?
It was great fun. And as you say, things were sort of just kicking off. After I won the Miss Ireland, Helen Joyce, who's now Helen Wogan, Terry Wogan's wife, and I were chosen to come to London to show a collection. So literally I won the Miss Ireland on, I think it was a Sunday evening, and Helen and I flew off at 4 o'clock the next morning to London for a 6 week showing of these clothes. No idea where we were going, no idea what we were doing. And during that time, I got a call from somebody called Don Bennett, and he said, as Miss Ireland, would I be interested in doing a quiz show with Gay Byrne? And that's how I started into television.
But this must have been so much fun because you were so young. I mean, you were only 17.
The only reason my mother let me go on this 6 week thing is because Helen was going. And she knew Helen, and she knew Helen was very sensible and would keep an eye on me. Well, Helen tried her best. And we did have fun. We really, really did have great fun together. She was she's still my very, very best friend to this day. Our friendship goes back nearly 50, 55, 60 years, which is extraordinary.
So then, Olive, you began your television career with Gay Byrne. And I have a photo with me from the archives from that time that you might actually remember.
I do remember this. I think this was in Stephen's Green. Easter? Was it Easter? Was this meant to be my Easter bonnet?
I think it was.
It's taken from the RTE archives, and it has a note in it saying that it was taken to promote the RTE quiz show Jackpot with Gay Byrne. And Olive, all I can say is that you just absolutely look gorgeous. You look like Grace Kelly there, but there's a definite cheekiness in your eyes.
How funny. That really does bring back memories, all good memories. But you see, it comes back to the luck thing again. It was just being in the right place at the right time. But that's a very, very funny picture.
I used to know her.
I think you look a bit like Jay Jagger. There's a real confidence in you there.
Somebody actually told me when I went to Ireland recently, one of the journalists, I can't remember her name now, she said, I remember you whizzing through Dublin on the back of a motorbike with a young boyfriend, not my boyfriend, boyfriend. And she said, we always, in later years, described you as our Kate Moss. So I think I might have had the rebellious streak.
I love that.
Well, at the time.
Well, I'd love you to tell me the story of the great romance of your life, Olive, with your husband, Kits Browning, who you met around this time when you were still a teenager. But before we go to that, let's go to a song that reminds you of your courtship with him. So this is Stardust by Nat King Cole. And tell me, why did you choose this song?
I chose this song because Kits was a devoted Frank Sinatra fan. And when we first met, and he obviously went back to London, he kept sending me LPs of Frank Sinatra, which I absolutely loathed. My mother loved him, so she kept saying, oh, more LPs coming. And I adored Nat King Cole. So our truce was that Kits would listen to more Nat King Cole, and I'd try and give Sinatra a go, and that's why we both adored Stardust.
And now the purple dusk of twilight time steals across the meadows of my heart. High up in the sky, the little stars climb, always reminding me that we're apart.
That was Stardust by Nat King Cole, chosen by my guest this morning, Olive White, Miss Ireland 1961. Olive, was it difficult to maintain a relationship with Kits because you were living in two different countries?
Well, it was because he was working on a film called The Running Man being made at Ardmore Studios, and I and some of the other girls went down as extras. So Kits and I actually met through swing doors. He was coming in and I was going out.
And what was it that caught your eye about him?
His blue check chef trousers, first of all. And then I looked up and I thought, oh, he's rather good news. And he must have done the same. And Noel Purcell was working on the film as an AD. And he actually was saying to me, oh, that chap has the hots for you. And also relaying the same information to Kits. So at the end of Picture Party, we sort of got together. Film finished, Kits went back to London. I was a bit sort of down, and he obviously was a bit down. So lots of telephone calls.
So you'd only had one evening together then?
No, we'd had one or two dates out. But the funny thing is, his name never sort of came into conversation, really. And he didn't know my name either. So, it was very peculiar. So he eventually said to me, this is ridiculous, I don't know your name. And I said, Olive. And his face fell. Whatever he thought my name was, he didn't think it was Olive. And I thought, well, that's that. And I said, well, I did stupid, what's your name? And he said, Kits. And I thought, Kits, what sort of name is that? Anyway, the long and the short of it was, he went back and we were in touch by telephone. He then said he was coming over for a weekend. And my mum says, well, now, don't be silly. You don't think he's coming over just to see you. It must be something to do with tying up the end of the film or whatever. So this went on backwards and forwards, Kits coming over for, a couple of months.
And what age were you now, Olive?
I was 17 and a bit.
So you're still very young.
Yes. My life happened very quickly, all in a space of 3 years.
And what age is Kits?
Kits was 22. So Kits came over for Christmas, 63 it would have been, 60, yeah, 63, and then met my parents. My mother thought he was lovely, and of course it was the old story, you know, A, he was Protestant, and B, young men like that don't sort of fall for girls like you. And
were you nervous introducing him when he was Protestant and he was English as well?
That never crossed Kits's mind or my mind. When you're actually in love, you don't think of these things. You just think everybody's going to like everybody and nothing is going to be a problem. And they all got on really, really well together. Kits went back. And then I came over to London for, I think, 3 weeks. So that's when Kits and I cemented our relationship. During that time, there was another film being made in Ireland. And I was introduced to the producer, who wanted me then to go to America.
And were you tempted to go?
Well, I was. And I said to Kitts, listen, I've got this offer. And he said, I tell you what, let's get engaged instead. So that's what we did.
Can I go back, Olive, to when you introduced Kitts to your parents and your mum said he was Protestant and that men like that don't fall for girls like you? What did she mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, she knew a bit about his background, in that he was sort of quite well to do and a very good family, and his father was knighted, and, you know, all sorts. And I think she was probably looking out for me, really. She didn't want me to get hurt or get carried away with myself. So when I was in London, Kit said, what do you think? And I said, well, you better ring home. So he rang home and my mum answered the phone and he said, Kitty, Olive and I would really like to get engaged and married. Would that be all right? Nothing to do with me. She said, you better speak to her father. And I think Kit said, Kevin, would it be all right? And by the way, I have tickets for the cup final at Wembley. So he said, you can have her. Absolutely, you can have her. So that was it.
Tell me then about the wedding itself, Olive. Was it taboo for a Catholic girl to get married to a Protestant?
It was. And Kit's took instruction. Obviously, he had to take instruction. And he had two amazing priests, one Father Michael Cleary and the other Tom Cullen. And I think we know about Michael Cleary. So he took Kitts under his wing and they used to play golf, and Kitts would ask questions about Catholic religion. And Michael would say, you missed the putt, and they'd go on, and he got his instruction that way.
And did he have to learn about the Catholic faith?
He didn't have to change his religion, but he had to be introduced into the Catholic faith.
Were you allowed to get married then in a Catholic church?
No, there was great taboo because of my being on television. They thought it would set a precedent that everybody, you know, could up and do what they liked. So, and the silly thing is, they changed it from my quiet parish church to Adam and Eve's along the Liffey, which, you know, was open to everybody. Mm. So half of Dublin turned out and people got run over by cars. And, oh, it was quite something. But Michael did our wedding and it had to be the back of the church.
So you weren't allowed to get married in the church itself?
No, I wasn't allowed to sort of walk down the aisle or anything like that, no.
Were you disappointed by that?
Yes, of course I was, because two wonderful ladies had made me this amazing dress. And, I didn't have my moment of walking down the aisle.
And Olive, you were a big celebrity at the time. Was everyone waiting for you outside?
Of course, I'd just finished the show the week before the wedding. So everybody was wishing me, you know, good luck. So the whole of Dublin knew, you know, because I was the first girl on television, really. Oh. Jackpot started the whole of Telefisha Éireann, really. Mm-hmm. So everybody felt that they were part of the television and the show. And so really half of Dublin turned out, and my own parish turned out as well. So it was absolute chaos. It was pure chaos.
And was that enjoyable or did it take from the day?
It did take from it, because somebody did actually get hurt. Somebody got their leg broken, but it all sort of settled down when we went to the reception, which was fine.
And tell me, did Kit's family enjoy the reception?
I think they got quite a shock, because we were in the Gresham and Father Michael was hosting the whole sort of thing. And after everybody had eaten and everything, he started the music and the singing. And Helen Joyce, now Wogan, sang My Love Is Like a Red, Red Rose, which, of course, floored everybody. She had the most amazing voice. Then Michael started to sing Fine Girl, You Are the Holy Ground. Well, the English guests didn't know. Talk about Irish crack. They absolutely realised what Irish crack was.
We'll have a listen to The Holy Ground in a minute, but as was the tradition of the time, Olive, your dad picked up the bill for your wedding.
Nancy had married before me. My other sister, Dorry, was engaged to be married, and then it was me. They had wonderful weddings, but obviously mine was, you know, going to cost my dad's arm and a leg, as it were. So he went to the Gresham, he sorted everything out, and to the day he died, he had the bill in his top pocket. He never got over having to fork out for his youngest daughter's wedding. You know, it was a standing joke. What's in your pocket? Your so-and-so bill is in my pocket. I could have been a rich man, but for you and your wedding, you know, it was a standard family joke.
But it sounds like, you know, he was a proud man and he wanted everything to be just right.
He wanted everybody to be happy on the day. He wanted all Kitts's family to feel comfortable and happy on the day. And they certainly did.
Well, this song, All of the Holy Ground, reminds you of your wedding reception. And this is a kind of a rowdy version from the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem. And that was The Holy Ground, sung by the Clancy Brothers. The song was chosen by Olive Browning, Miss Ireland 1961, because it brings back great memories of her wedding reception at the Gresham Hotel. Recently, Olive, on a visit to Dublin, both you and Kitts, you took a sentimental journey in search of the place where Kitts stayed 50 years ago during your courtship. Did you manage to find that place?
Originally, he stayed in a hotel, and then he was backwards and forwards quite a lot. So he took a flat in Balls Bridge, opposite, I think it was the Intercontinental Hotel then. But funnily enough, the last time we were in Dublin, which was just before Christmas, we went on a sort of retracing our footsteps, what we used to do, where we used to go. Could we find the flat? Neither of us could remember what number it was, which house it was. So it was all a bit disappointing, really, trying to sort of bring back memories. Old age creeping up on both of us, I'm afraid.
Where else did you go on that visit?
We used to go out to Bray quite a lot. Always had the pint in the pub in Bray. We used to go to Black Rock for sort of long walks. We actually went back up Clogger Road where I used to live. And I have to say, my goodness, my house, or my old house now, looks quite different. It's got pillars. There's trees planted up and down the street. Really quite impressive. Now,
did you go in?
There was a young man cleaning a car and we were standing outside, and I think he thought we might be social security or something, and he looked quite nervous. So I thought, no, I've got to do this. So I said, look, excuse me, I actually used to live here. Did you? He said. So we just had a chat and it was lovely to have a look at it again.
And that is Olive Browning, Miss Ireland 1961. It's very nice to think that Olive and Kitts are still together 50 years after they first met in Ardmore Studios in Bray. It seems that the girl who grew up in Crumlin in Dublin called Olive White has had a very fortunate life. So I ask Olive, was it a lucky life, and have there been any challenges in it as well?
Do you know, honestly, it sounds very smug to say this, but no, there hasn't really. We have really been blessed. We have four fantastic children. I just couldn't have asked for three more handsome, gorgeous boys and a beautiful daughter. She really is quite stunning, such fun, and six grandchildren. And we all have our health.
But you also seem, you know, very positive, Olive. What keeps you going?
I always think tomorrow is going to be extra special. And I don't let things sort of worry me or get me down, because as far as I'm concerned, it could always be worse. Whatever the situation, it could always be worse. And nothing lasts forever. Everything passes.
Well, that's a great philosophy to take. We're going to listen to Red Hurley's version of How Great Thou Art. Are you religious, Olive? Is that why you chose this song?
You know, like most Irish people who've left home, you do. I mean, remember, I was very young and everything was very exciting. So going to Mass and Holy Confession really were not top of my agenda when I was younger. But I think once you have a family and once, you know, you want everything to be right for them, you start to appreciate your Catholic upbringing and the importance of prayer, really. And when I first heard this song, do you know, I get terribly emotional. I'm going to have to stop.
Why does it make you emotional?
I don't know. I'd heard this hymn many times, many, many times. But it was Red Hurley's interpretation that it just floored me. And actually, Kitts too, we both said, oh my God. And it was just like being struck, really. And that's all I can really explain it to you, that perhaps it brought everything back, perhaps it brought my mum and dad back, I don't know what it was. But ever since I heard that, I've been slightly more religious. Yeah, that's what that song did for me at that particular time. It just shook me.
So you've said, Olive, that listening to the song makes you more religious. But what do you mean by that?
I think perhaps maybe religious is not the right word. I think it's a sort of more spiritual feeling. And religious, yes, in a sense that, you know, you suddenly think life is very precious. We're all getting older. You know, a lot of our good friends through the years have passed away.
And being philosophical, does that come with age?
I think it does. And I think it also comes with grandchildren. I just think young people today are missing out on that stabilising family traditional thing. Mm-hmm.
The little things.
The little things that read back to the very beginning, yes. And they do.
Well, we'll have a listen to Red Hurley singing How Great Thou Art. Oh,
then sings my soul, my Saviour God, to thee. Sings my soul, my Saviour God, to thee. How great thou art, how great thou art.
That was Red Hurley singing How Great Thou Art. Olive, you've settled now in England with your four children. Do you ever miss home?
I have to say, no, I didn't. Helen and Terry had moved over now to London. So closest friends were still closest friends and just around the corner, really. And life was really very busy, you know, with one, two, three, four children. So I didn't really miss home very much. Every time I had a new baby arrived, I'd ring Mum. She'd say, "Is she lovely?" And I said, "Mum, it's a little boy." And then Mum became very ill. So my last pregnancy, she was really very, very ill. And I rang. She was just out of hospital, her final couple of weeks. Mm. And I rang and she said, "How is he?" I said, "You're not going to believe this, Mum. I've got a little girl." Well, that was the icing on the cake for her. Unfortunately, she never saw Grace. Mm. She died a month after Grace was born.
So you must have been quite young then when your mother passed away.
I was 30. I felt very lonely because Mum always came over when I had a baby. You know, she used to come over and stay and help me out for, you know, 4 weeks or 3 weeks or something after each baby. I did miss her terribly, yes, I really did. And there were times, you know, you think, oh, God, if only Mum was here, she'd know mm-hmm. what to do. But, you know, you battle on and you get there in the end.
And did you see your sisters then quite a lot?
No, I didn't. And that's the sad thing, you know, it was only an hour away. And it's only really recently that I've started to go back to Dublin. We had a play running at the Gate Theatre just before Christmas.
Yes, my cousin Rachel, adapted by Joseph O'Connor.
We thought it was great. We've seen an awful lot of productions of that play, but that particular one, I think, was absolutely super. It seemed to have the audience totally mm-hmm. under its spell. So, you know, the leading up to that and seeing that, and then we went over for something else.
Loads of connections.
Suddenly, in the last, I don't know, 2 years perhaps, and I think perhaps, again, it's to do with age and we're all getting on a little bit, we realise actually how important mm-hmm. we all are to each other because we're still all here. So hopefully we'll be all here for a very long time to
Indeed.
Come.
And you said that yourself and Kits have been over to see my cousin Rachel. I'd like to talk a little bit about Daphne du Maurier. Now, she was a very private person, but obviously, you know, there's great interest in her personal life as well. How do you react as a family to this interest in her personal life?
Well, I think there's, you know, there's been an awful lot written and an awful lot of books out recently depicting all sorts of aspects of Daphne's life. But you must remember, she came from an extraordinary family. I mean, they were so theatrical, the family, bohemian, if you like. I mean, in the days when she was a young girl, the circles that she mixed in was totally theatrical. Her father was the best actor of his day, and then he was a director of a theatre. A very privileged background, if you like, she and her sisters. So everything was there for them to experiment with, and indeed, I dare say, they did. But my knowledge of Daphne was totally different, and on a personal level, she was the most perfect mother-in-law. I mean, Kitts and I travelled an awful lot with her. We went to France, we went to Greece, lots of times. Mm-hmm. And she was incredible company, really. We always felt that she had her eye on what was going on around, because she'd say, "Did you notice that man?" "No." And then you suddenly would, you know, take in what was going on behind you. But she obviously did.
She's very observant.
Very observant. And was very naughty too. If there were sort of handsome men around, she'd say, "Darling, would you fancy him?" And I say, "No." "Yes." So she had an amazing sense of humour that, of all the books that have been written, none of them have realised what a sense of humour she had. Mm-hmm. All the family have, actually. And I think that's very sad, because, you know, they just missed out on a very, very important part of her. Mm-hmm. That was very special to us and the children and grandchildren.
Was she a warm grandmother?
Wonderful. She didn't really like them around or during the day, because she was obviously perhaps busy and thinking. We used to go down for the month of August, and it was the evenings. She'd play cricket with the children every evening. We had a silly little cup that used to be played for. She'd present it to whoever was the best of the day, and it was always Ned's, my third son's, birthday when we were down, so a great cake would be done and she'd come and have tea with everybody. And then children would well be put to bed, and she'd go up when everybody was asleep and sort of sneak in and see that they were all right. So she was a wonderful, wonderful woman.
And was all of this happening in Menabilly? Because that was the basis of, you know, the House Manderley in her novel Rebecca.
Daphne moved from Menabilly about 3 years after Kitts and I were married, and moved into the dower house of Menabilly, which is a house called Kilmarth, which was an amazing house, beautiful house, rolling hills down to the sea. And she was very, very happy there, and mm-hmm. that's where she died.
Daphne du Maurier is probably best known for her books like, you know, Rebecca, The Birds, or Don't Look Now. And some people have said that she hasn't written women in a very good light, or that maybe she didn't even like women. Is that just the way her narratives were, or does it reflect really how she was in real life?
I think in her books, the I person was always male, and that's how she wrote. But yes, she had wonderfully close women friends. And what people probably aren't too familiar with is her short stories, which are amazing, absolutely amazing.
Some of them are so dark, they are petrifying to read.
They are. And I think the wonderful thing is that most of the books that you've mentioned, the reader is always left with a question. Did he kill her? Did she kill him? You know, you're always left. I mean, I asked Daphne, did Rachel actually kill Ambrose? And she looked at me shocked. "Darling," she said, "I don't know. Do you think he did?" And I said, "Well, I think she did." "Oh," she said, "I'll have to rethink it again." So, you know, I don't think she knew herself, quite honestly.
But she knew her craft. What was your favourite book that she wrote?
I think it would have to be The Progress of Julius, which is a little known book, but would make the most amazing film. Very topical. And she has another book called Rule Britannia, which could be today. It absolutely could be about the political situation today, the way America, China. I mean, it's quite amazing to think it was written all those years ago, and yet could be written today.
Our last song was written by a friend of yours. Can you tell me something about it?
When we moved into Ferryside, where we are now, we met Peter Skellen and his wife Diana. And Peter's a songwriter and musician. And he wrote this song for Diana, his wife. And I can't think of a nicer thing for anybody to do. This is a beautiful song.
You're describing, you know, your friend's romance there, but Olive, you and Kits have been together since you've been barely 18. You're happy, you've reared your four children, you've six grandchildren. What is the secret?
Compromise. Compromise. We're very lucky. We're both of like-minded people. And, you know, yes, it hasn't all been smooth. Nothing ever is. But, you know, as I said earlier, nothing is that important. Everything will pass. There's always tomorrow. So if there's been an argument or a disagreement, sort it out. Just sort it out. Don't ever leave something until the next day because it's not worth it. So I think that's the answer. Yes, darling, a lot. Yes, you're right, a lot. And after 50 years, I've learned the lesson. It is compromise.
And that very good piece of advice brings our programme to an end this morning. I was talking to Olive Browning, originally Olive White from Dublin. This programme was researched by Ger Philpott, location sound by Kenny Barnes, and it was produced by Eileen Herron. Our last piece of music this morning is Peter Skellerin's How Loved You Are.
We speak in glances, watched by stars above, silently in love. And the firelight dances in your tender eyes, and this romance is...
Evening and Company on RTE Radio 1. Podcast the show at rte.ie/radio player.